So now that we've heard from Stu about his experience as an expert witness and the arguments that he used, we're going to hear from the lead attorney representing the White Bear Lake Restoration Association. So how does a litigator approach a groundwater case? That's what we're going to hear about. Katie Crosby Lehman is a founder and managing partner of Cerisi Conlon, LLP. She graduated from the University of Notre Dame with a degree in economics and attended William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul. So with that, Katie, I hand it over to you. Thank you.
Stu and I didn't share our presentations, but you can see I picked up right where he left off, which having a Steve Sack cartoon about something that you worked on is a pretty big highlight of my career so far, and I think it's fantastic. And I think it builds in well with what you all have been talking about today, which is how to tell a story about something that's invisible. And so Steve Sack's cartoon really did help that. And this whole case brought to light the canary in the coal mine, which is White Bear Lake, and it brought to light that this is a problem. We need to manage it. We might not all agree on the causes, the problems, what we should be discussing, or how we should be addressing it, but at least we're talking about it. Minnesotans now understand that we do have a water problem, even though we have lots of water. So science and the law. I've been practicing in patent infringement litigation is how I grew up in the law, and then I do a lot in environmental work as well. So anytime there's a science interaction, I'll come in and help on those cases, and I really enjoyed working with Stu and all of our experts and doing the trial work. And so how are science cases different than other cases? They're really not. If you have a fire explosion, you're going to learn everything there is about the fire explosion, where the fire started, what caused the fire, and what was the damage because of the fire. If you have a flood, same thing. And so no matter what the issue is, you're going to learn everything there is to learn about it. And you're going to start with the legal elements. You're going to understand the statutes that are at issue. You're going to understand the facts that are issued, and you're going to become an expert. And so you develop this really pocketed expertise. And so I might have an expertise in the studies that Stu did, but then I know nothing beyond that. And so a lot of the talks today, I felt like I knew something about groundwater, but yet because it's outside the pocket of knowledge that I learned for the White Bear Lake case, I'm not necessarily going to know about it. One thing that did come up in the other speakers today, too, is how to communicate clearly and simply. And working with Stu and Dr. Funky, one thing that we did was they would explain to us what the issue was, and we'd say, nope, that's not how you're going to do it again. And then you do it again. I'm like, nope, still don't get it. Do it again. It's like, okay, there. That's what we're going to do. That's how we're going to describe it. Let's revise the graph. Let's revise the presentation so that everyone can understand it. And then with that expectation of that's how you communicate clearly, what do we need to build into that? What do we need to describe before we get to that so that that is the clear message? One thing that's uncomfortable for scientists and experts is that you have to have an answer. You have to be able to provide an opinion to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty. That doesn't mean that you know it exactly, but that you mean you have to be able to testify to that level of certainty. Otherwise, your expert testimony will not appear in trial. It'll be excluded under the Daubert standard. So what's MARA? In the 1970s, Minnesota followed Michigan and created this law. And basically, it's a citizens' enforcement statute. So citizens get to police the state agencies, companies, anyone who's destroying our natural resources. So it's all outlined by statute, Minnesota Statute 116B.01. And it says that each person is entitled by right to protect, preserve, and enhance our air, water, land, and other natural resources, both today and into the future. And it's not only that we have the right, but we have the responsibility to do this, and that it's Minnesota state legislative policy to have humans and nature interact in productive harmony now and in the future. And so a lot of our case was about now, and it was also about the future. So we modeled what can happen in the future based on how we know weather patterns go and how the cycles of just living goes. So who can protect our natural resources? Everyone. Anyone can maintain a civil action against someone else. It's not for money. You have no way of getting money, in fact. And you're bringing this action to protect our air, water, land, or other natural resources. And you're protecting it from pollution, impairment, or destruction. And so there's one caveat for this, And the caveat is you can't sue someone who is acting pursuant to an environmental quality standard, rule, or permit. So if the DNR issues the city of White Bear Lake a permit for 100 gallons and they're using 80 gallons, you can't sue White Bear Lake for using 80 gallons because they're acting pursuant to a permit. Instead, you can go, you can sue the DNR and said that permit that you issued for the 100 gallons isn't sufficient to protect the natural resource. And that's important. And I call this the agency loop. I'll talk about it here. Well, I'll just jump to it. So here's the 116B.10. So this is the statute that says if you're suing someone, if you're complaining about a permit, you can sue the agency for the permit, and then you get agency deference. This is what the appeal is about now. It's a completely non-scientific, non-factual legal issue that's subject to appeal. And while I've been sitting here today, the DNR filed its response brief. So I'll be reading that tonight, and then in 10 days submitting our reply, and then arguing in front of the Minnesota Supreme Court in a month or two. So that's all I'm going to say about where we are today, but the science is much more interesting. So pollution, impairment, or destruction is defined by statute, and it means two different things. So these are two avenues, two paths of getting there, and the DNR violated both of them, according to the district court. So the DNR pollutes, impairs, or destroys the natural resource of White Bear Lake and the underlying aquifer by violating laws. So we showed at least four laws that the DNR has violated. The DNR was found to drain White Bear Lake without replacing equal quality water. The DNR was found to cause a negative impact to White Bear Lake, which then puts you in the surface water regime of meeting those laws and didn't follow those laws. The DNR claimed to not have sufficient knowledge on the impact of the groundwater to the surface water, and there's a law that says if you don't have sufficient knowledge, you can't allow appropriations. So if we take you, DNR, at your word that you don't have the information that's needed, then you couldn't have allowed these appropriations. And that there's another surface water to groundwater. Once we proved that the surface water was being impacted by the groundwater, the DNR had to follow different regulations, and one of them was required that the groundwater use was sustainable for future generations and that there was a contingency plan in each city's water plan, and that wasn't being done either. And then the second avenue to prove a MARA violation is conduct that materially adversely affects or is likely to materially adversely affect the natural resources. And so this is any kind of harm. And so we went through and proved the harm to the resource both by, the examples of the drawdown of the lake. You can't use the beach. You can't use the lake. You have trees growing. You've seen the pictures. We went through all of that. And then we also went through into the future. White Bear Lake's a very shallow lake, so it has a large littoral zone. And so if you lose 25%, if you lose 25% of the water, this was Dr. Funke's analysis, I might get it wrong too, but if you lose 25% of the water, you're gonna lose a significant part of the lake. And that had happened in 2013, and it was predicted to happen again as well. And so by losing 25% of the lake, you're losing almost all your littoral zone, which is where the fish and plants grow. And so that has a pretty big impact. So if we have this MARA law and we're all able to protect our natural resources, why don't we see more of these cases? Well, they're really hard, they're really expensive, and there's serious legislative risks, which the DNR put us through during this case. So it cost us about $2 million in attorney's fees to litigate this case. And we did it all for free because it's part of our mission, which is we need to support our community. We need to highlight issues that are long-term issues for the state of Minnesota and hope that just by highlighting them, we're going to encourage a change in policy so that we manage our water better. The legislative risk is that this is a law, and laws can change. And during the case, the DNR went and changed the law to try to make it, well, they did make it slightly harder. So the law used to say when there's a potential of an impact between groundwater harming a surface water, then the surface water regime of laws kicks in. And they changed the law, lobbied to change the law to say when there is a negative impact by the groundwater withdrawals to the surface water, then the surface water kicks in. And that was fine. We were always planning on proving to a higher standard anyway, and so we were able to roll with that, thankfully. But that's a real risk, which is the law might get changed while you're litigating it. If that happens, what happens to your case? Well, it can just go away. So you don't know. And throughout the case, the DNR has threatened to change the law so that groundwater isn't part of MARA. I hope that never happens. The groundwater is an incredible natural resource, and I think I'm preaching to the choir here, but that is a consideration that's come up, and I like to highlight that because I think that would be a terrible result for the state of Minnesota. There's many ways to lose a groundwater case, which is another reason why you don't do it. And this was a hard-fought case on all sides. I really enjoyed litigating against the DNR. You know, I'm a litigator. Litigation is about fighting and conflict. And so that's my world, and fighting and conflict isn't a bad thing. That's how you often get to the best answer. And so I'll talk about the fights and the conflicts that we had, and I don't mean any disrespect. That's part of the process. That is, you know, those are the cases that go to trial. Very few cases go to trial. But the ones that do should, because there are good arguments on both sides, and you want to have the truthful, honest, open testimony that all the public can observe to help us get to that point. So there's all these legal obstacles throughout a case. Right after you file a case, you can lose by a motion to dismiss. The DNR brought that. And then you can lose later on in the case after you have all the discovery when you have a motion for a summary judgment, and the DNR brought that, motion for a new trial, motion to exclude evidence. You know, so all these things happen, and so we're constantly fighting and pushing the rock uphill trying to survive. And then you have not enough evidence, wrong evidence, bad evidence, no empathy for your client, no compelling story, and it just doesn't feel fair. And those last three are really the things that when you talk about, in trial you talk about a burden of proof, which is meeting the basic elements of your case, and a burden of persuasion. And those last three are really that burden of persuasion, which is if the judge doesn't like you, no matter how good your case is, he or she's going to rule against you or find some way to do so. And so we knew that we had to have this really compelling story. We knew that everyone would say there's no way to prove where the groundwater is, where it's going, and why it's depleting. And so we tried, our intent was to overprove our case, which is we looked at every study, and so we lined up all these studies, and we knew we had to do that because we knew there's this idea, and a lot of it came out today, that groundwater is invisible, Minnesota has a lot of water, therefore we're fine. And so we were always fighting that. We were always recognizing that we had to fight against that. And the just doesn't feel fair part, we were donating our time. We leaned on Stu to reduce his fees. You know, we tried every angle we could. It was a low-budget process for us, but the clients had to raise significant funds to pay for experts. It was still in the hundreds of thousands of dollars that we had to raise to cover all the experts that we had involved. And so it's a difficult case, but we weren't seeking damages. We weren't seeking money. These weren't people who were trying to recover money to, you know, build a better house or something like that. It was really about trying to recognize our natural resources and bring it to light that there was a problem. So here's the flip side. How do you win a case? Well, everything has to line up. You need that story. You need the evidence. Importantly, you need to deal with bad facts, and we had some too. There were some parts of the USGS story that report that Stu didn't agree with and that the DNR wanted to attack, and so what we did is we highlighted them first. And so, you know, we were quick to say, did you agree with every aspect of the USGS report? And there was an issue about wells being included or not included, and we drew that out. So then when the DNR gets up and raises it, it's not like an aha moment. It's just like, yeah, no big deal. We accounted for that, and it's fine. But that's really important, and it's hard to do because it's harder to confront the things that you don't like. But if you avoid them, it's often in life, like anything else, it becomes a bigger problem. So we won at trial. It was about a four-week trial, 3.5 weeks, March 2017. We had 26 witnesses, hundreds of exhibits got entered. Paul Putzier testified for 2 days. I'm not sure if anyone else in here other than Stu testified as well. It was a very, I considered a very open and welcoming courtroom. It sounds weird because we're fighting with each other, but we really worked well with the DNR's counsel, and I've got a lot of respect for them and the judge. And after the day's testimony would end, the judge would come down and talk to all of us and try to make it personable. She knew how hard we were all working and not sleeping, and she wanted to show her dedication for that too. She, for the most part, took, well, for the whole part, she took handwritten notes. So there was a court reporter there, but she was taking handwritten notes, and she probably filled up at least 10 legal pads of just her handwritten notes, because the turnaround is so fast. And so the case gets tried, and then the judge has 90 days to get her opinion out after briefing. And her opinion was 140 pages long, very well documented with the exhibits and the testimony. So then we're at appeal. We lost on appeal on that agency loop that I talked about. The briefs came in today. Well, the Minnesota Supreme Court took the case, and we'll deal with that coming up. So at trial, everyone was an expert. I mean, the key witnesses for the DNR were all hydrologists, hydrogeologists, and so it really was interesting. It wasn't just the paid experts. It was everyone talking about their fields and talking about, this is my life, this is what I do. And so it was fascinating. On our side, we had Dr. Funke. She was a limnologist with EOR. She also did modeling, and the modeling was critical, and she talked about the littoral zone, the change in fish and plants. And then Stu, and you saw part of his presentation. We probably had 200 slides, Stu, of what your presentation went through. And so we together mapped it all out so that we could get it flowing. And just like anything that you see today, you want it to be entertaining, you want it to move, you want it to kind of jump around so that you can build your story and yet not lose interest. And one part of our story was we had the shift in the hydrograph. And so you had, no matter what happens now, the highs of White Bear Lake are lower and the lows are lower. So you have lower lows, lower highs. And we actually had all of DNR's experts agree to that as well. Like I said, trials are conflict. My world is conflict. And so I'm not personally attacking anyone, but part of it is when you do a cross-examination, you want to draw out what the other side agrees with on your side and highlight the differences, highlight the lack of credibility, highlight the tension, and that's what we did here as well, or we tried to do as best we could. So Stu hit it on the head when he said one reason we had him model and out at the lake so much, we had him out for the whole time he was working on the case, was for credibility in addition to his modeling. The DNR experts really didn't do, they didn't do any modeling. They were there to attack ours, but not to do any of their own. They all agreed that groundwater pumping is a direct cause of White Bear Lake level declines, and the other cause is climate, and that humans can only control pumping. And so that was another theme that we had come out with every single expert. This shifting of the hydrograph, one of the key points where the DNR attacked the USGS study was on precipitation and evaporation and that it wasn't properly accounted for. And then on cross-examination, it came out that it was accounted for. And that they would agree that we went through this whole laundry list of studies, and I'll tick through them here in a little bit. But they would agree they'd all be true today. So we were on cross-examination on our own experts, we wanted to prove our case. On cross, we wanted to establish that the lack of dispute on the science. And precipitation was another major issue. The precipitation just couldn't explain the problems that we faced starting in 2003 to 2010. And then there are a couple more DNR experts. I thought this was kind of devastating for the DNR that they had planned to use the USGS model. They were working with them on it, and this is all public evidence. And then when they thought the model was going to show a very minimal, like a 3-inch change of the water level, and then when the model came out and showed a 1.5-foot change for a 30% drop in pumping, they abandoned it and would never use it. And they admitted that it was state-of-the-art and wouldn't use it. Martin Jennings, another DNR on fisheries, all these people are good people. The evidence just came out not exactly on their side. And this is something that if you're an expert witness, you have to be aware of this. The cross-examination is when I get the most sick to my stomach. So I wasn't worried about Stu or Megan when they were up for direct examination, but I could puke when they were being crossed. And so that's the hardest part. And there were yeah, it's difficult. And so, but these are the points that I'm highlighting today. And all these people did a great job. And like I said, it was our job to highlight the weaknesses. I mean, cross-examination by definition is when you're examining someone closely for the purpose of discrediting them. I mean, that's the role of cross-examination. It's not a personal attack. But some of this is interesting. I just have to put on my glasses to read it. So the DNR's lead expert was Tonkin, and he was an outside expert. And Stu set this up for me when talking about all the things we had him do. So this is my first greeting of him. We didn't depose them. It was a cost issue. So in Minnesota, if you depose people's experts, you have to pay for it, and we didn't have the funds to do it. And so we went in kind of blind. We had their expert reports and then just crossed them based on that. So good afternoon. I want to clarify some of the things you did and didn't do as part of your opinions, okay? Sure. You did not do any field tests at White Bear Lake, did you? No. You did not go to White Bear Lake and observe it in 2013, did you? No. Or any time since then. I visited the site yesterday. Yesterday. Was that the first time you saw it? Yes. That was after all your opinions had been rendered in the case. Yes. That's correct, yes. You didn't rely on the DNR's plans or ideas or analysis related to the protected elevation, right? You didn't rely on the DNR's plan to implement an irrigation ban as a possible trigger for the protected elevation, right? You didn't do any of the analysis relating to seasonal water use, right? I did actually look at seasonal pumping and patterns over the season, but it's not included in my report. It's not in your report. It's like you never did it because he couldn't have testified to it. You didn't issue an opinion on seasonal water use, did you? No. So that's a bad setup for an expert. So part of the expert, you know, like I said at the very beginning, it's about telling a story, about building credibility. You want people to like you, you want people to believe in you, and you want people to think that you did everything you could in your power to understand the lake. And it didn't come out like that. And then here's one other example. He did a calibration analysis. And I can't tell you that I completely understand this, but I will tell you he picked 9 wells out of 900 or so, and all the wells were on the northeast side, and it just didn't make any sense to me because I thought, out of all the wells around the lake, those are the ones that are going to have the least impact. And then he picked 9 out of hundreds. I, as a layperson, it didn't add up, and sometimes that's all it takes. And here is the court's response to this. So, and this is out of the court's opinion. So this is Tonkin was analyzing the USGS model calibration and concluded that the conductivity used in the model was too high. He based this conclusion on a small sample of only 7 out of 900 wells. Furthermore, despite the fact that the U.S. study found that White Bear Lake water is the likely source of surface water found in 11 wells south and downgradient of the lake, Dr. Tonkin chose to plot the calibration of wells that were northeast of the lake. He offered no meaningful explanation for his choice of either the limited number of wells or their location. And so this is an example of maybe it was okay, I don't know, to do the calibration in that way. But he couldn't tell me that. Like when asked, he wasn't prepared to explain why he picked those couple wells when there were hundreds he could have picked from and why the location was okay. And so the court picked up on that too. And one thing when you're an expert, as attorneys, we look at everything that's come up in the case, but we also dig around in your history, in your past. And we look for any reports and studies that you've done, and we want to see, when you're outside the litigation context, what did you say about White Bear Lake? And so that's one thing that we did with the DNR expert Solstad. We knew that he had studied both Lake Minnetonka and White Bear Lake. And both we knew that both lakes had a similar response in the Dust Bowl and the 88-89 time, but different. And so we took him through this, and you can see the first drop is the Dust Bowl. I can't see it. In the 1930s, and then you see 88-89, the drop on the drought. And then it says average lake elevation for 2005 to 2014 period, 0.71 feet above the average lake elevation for the period of record. So just remember that 0.71 feet. And then we look at White Bear Lake, and this is his pre-litigation analysis that he's done. This isn't related to our case. And you can see the Dust Bowl drop down. You can see the 88 drop down. But then we have this third drop, which, you know, when he's testified that Lake Minnetonka and White Bear Lake historically reacted the same way, now we see that they didn't. So how do you explain that? And here it says the average lake elevation for 05 to 14 period is 2.39 feet below the average lake elevation for the period of record. So that's a pretty significant difference. So we talked to him about that. I talked to him about it. And it says here it says the average lake elevation for 5 through 14 is 2.39 feet. Do you see that? You know, I have no reason to disagree with that. That's correct. So if we go to the next page, we go to Lake Minnetonka. It's actually 0.71 feet above the average lake elevation for the period of record. Do you see that? Yes. You agree with that? Yes. So during the recent time period, there's been about a 4-foot swing between Lake Minnetonka and White Bear Lake, correct? Yes. So now in the recent time frame, they're certainly not reacting the same way, correct? There's likely many causes. In 88, 89, they reacted the same way to drought, correct? Today, they're not reacting the same way to climate, correct? Their lake level plots do not look the same. And so this is an example of, you know, we were able to find old information that applied to our case, and he didn't have a good explanation for it. I know why he didn't. He couldn't have a good explanation for it because it's pumping, you know. And so here's the court's response. Between 2005 and 2014, the average lake elevation was 2.39 feet below the long-term average of 923.8. By comparison, during the same time period, Lake Minnetonka was 0.71 feet above the lake average lake elevation for a net difference of more than 3 feet. So I highlight this not to attack the DNR, not to attack expert Solstad. They're all great people. But we know the problem. No one's disagreeing. The science is not disputed. We try to argue, we have heard arguments that the science is disputed, but that's not how it came out at trial. And this case was decided about based on the facts that came out in trial. It's a snapshot. And it was clear and it was agreed upon. The Metropolitan Council was viewed as a neutral expert. And when you cross-examine someone, you can ask them leading questions. I wasn't able to ask the Met Council leading questions. I had to treat them sort of like they were one of my own witnesses. So I had to say very open-ended questions, like, what happened next? And what do you think of this? And so it was a much less controlled direct examination for me because I couldn't prepare the witness. I knew a little bit what he was going to say based on information that they provided. But because of this, his testimony was very favorable for us. And when you have a neutral expert testify in your favor, it has a huge impact because they didn't have a role in the case. They weren't advocating for one side or the other. They were trying to be neutral to all sides and just provide information that they understood. And they, you know, Dr. Ali Alassan testified that White Bear Lake is a bathtub with holes. That they provided early tools to the DNR to evaluate the cumulative impact back in 2005. They've warned of inertia, and the inertia being that when you have the water, when things have just kind of gone into place, it just wants to carry on that way. And in the 70s and 80s, the wells were drawn. It's be really hard now to make the difference and switch to surface water, and that hardness is, you know, the hard choice, the hard decisions really is what's driving our water choices now, which in my view is wrong. But they, you know, he just explained that pumping, climate and pumping are causing White Bear Lake decline. Pumping is the only one that's controlled by humans, and that we did very detailed evidence on the role of irrigation. And so in the Met Council's own documents, we had these pictures of people mowing the lawn and the grass, and this is during trial, and this is all very straight face. You know, what is it showing in these pictures? Because I couldn't lead. These pictures show receding lake level in White Bear Lake. Are these examples of lake level decline in your mind? They are. Is it normal to mow the lake bed? It is not normal to mow a lake bed. And there was no laughing in trial. I mean, I thought it was really kind of funny, but it was very straight-faced and very quiet. But this is the 2010, and I won't read this, but as part of the 2010 Met Council plan, they informed the DNR and all the cities about the impact of groundwater withdrawals and that they're connected with the surface water groundwater connection and the problem of inertia, and that groundwater withdrawals can reduce the amount of water that would discharge to surface waters. And it's residential irrigation in my mind, which is the low-hanging fruit. And so you look at this, you look at the water use, the green water uses in the summer, the blue is in the winter. It should be embarrassing to all of us. But that is also what's driving this case. People do not want to give up their green grass. And so people got inflamed over the result, and that's one of the most major reasons why. This is the same chart that Stu had, too. This was all highlighted through the Met Council. We went through city by city. There's no city that's different. They all have this high water use in the summer months. So we went through fact witnesses. Like I said, the DNR's fact witnesses were also experts. It was a backdoor to enter more scientific evidence, as it should be. Their attitude was that the agency knows best, the law should not interfere, and that's a theme that we've been dealing with throughout the entire case. So Jason Michelino is good on the road show, and I'm not personally attacking him, but this is, he was their first fact witness, and this is how it went for him. So White Bear Lake's vulnerable to groundwater withdrawals, correct. So that's human activity, making those withdrawals that doesn't happen naturally. That happens through permits, through people pumping the water out of the aquifer, correct? Yes. And all the human activities authorized by the DNR, yes. The DNR studies groundwater withdrawals because White Bear Lake is vulnerable to them, yes. Groundwater adds stress to the aquifer, yes. And the aquifer is connected hydraulically, connected to the White Bear Lake. Which aquifer? Prairie du Chien. Yes. That means they rise and fall together, yes. So stress to the aquifer that results in lowering the aquifer level results in lowering the lake level, yes. White Bear Lake is a closed basin lake, yes. And closed basin lakes are more vulnerable to low and fluctuating lake levels, right? Yes. So we know White Bear Lake is vulnerable. It's connected to the groundwater system. We also know it's vulnerable because it's a closed basin lake, right? Yes. And so the court understood the science. If there's any idea that courts don't understand science or juries, I never believe people who say that, because it's all about the presentation, and they get it. The court understood here, too, that the DNR has had the information to review permits on a cumulative basis for years and has just chosen not to. So despite knowing how to review cumulatively, in 2013 admitted that it had not been considering regional or cumulative impact. This is after we sued them, when reviewing permit requests. Instead, it had been using the water appropriation permit on a case-by-case basis because that's what worked in the past. If there's no other role in bringing this lawsuit, this and the residential irrigation, those are two of the most important ones where we need to start taking a bigger role in managing our water resources. So after going through the fact and the experts and the science, we also had DNR's own documents, and this is what they had been talking about as talking points. And so they had been telling communities around the Northeast Metro that the DNR is committed to helping find solutions for future generations, but they're recognizing here that under point two, White Bear Lake may be the canary in the coal mine and be signaling the potential future impacts of metro area groundwater withdrawals on our lakes and rivers, and that the current record low water levels in White Bear Lake are due primarily to a precipitation deficit since 2006. There wasn't a drought, but fine. But the increase in groundwater pumping is in the area is probably to blame for making the low lake levels worse. So we piled on from the testimony along with their documents. And the court picked up on this too, and it was important to her to see that it wasn't that this is an unknown problem, it was a known problem, and it just wouldn't be fixed. And so she explained that even while acknowledging that there's a serious problem with overuse of groundwater, the DNR has continued to permit excessive groundwater pumping from the aquifer. This practice is not sustainable. It has a negative effect on natural resources. It's unreasonable and irresponsible. And again, this is from the DNR's own documents, that business as usual is no longer an option. And so the DNR was warning the communities that we need to make a change. Changes are hard, and I have complete sympathy for them for that, but it is time to make a change. And just again, with some more across, you know, groundwater use may be having impacts to important surface water features in this area, including White Bear Lake, yes. And the DNR was telling everyone that there were concerns about groundwater quality in the area as well, right? Yep. And all groundwater users within this place are hydrogeologically related. Their use impacts the same aquifers. That's true. Yes. So the entire Northeast groundwater management area of groundwater impacts each other. Yep. And so Stu was talking about the 5-mile area, but the DNR had on its own used a statutory requirement to create this groundwater management area where they could control, and we were able using it against him isn't the right word, but kind of. We're like, you know, talking out both sides of your mouth. On the one side, you're saying, I'm using state funds to create a groundwater management area because the groundwater in this area is not sustainable for future generations. And at the same time, in our case, say we're fine. And so the court understood inertia too and said that there's built-in inertia in the system that's driving the status quo. You know, basically municipalities, they didn't want us touching their water use. They still don't. They push back on anything the DNR tries to do. And I get that. But if you're the one, you know, if you're the parent in the room, you got to make that hard choice. Just, I have three teenagers, and they don't like everything that I decide, and they're going to be mad at me for a while, but in the long run, it's the best thing to do, and, you know, I encourage the DNR to make those hard choices, too. And I think the court was, that's what she was getting at here in talking about inertia. So Sue talked about Chapter B. I won't get into this. I talked about this a little bit. DNR Assistant Commissioner Naramore testified that the steady state model was not good enough until after the DNR saw the results of the model. So there was fact, you know, the documents show that they were willing to use it until they saw the results and then decided it wasn't good enough. And expert Tonkin did testify that the model was state-of-the-art and a very good model. And you have to think about trial. You guys think about science as always evolving. And when you're in trial, you have a snapshot. And you make the decision based only on the evidence that's in that snapshot. So is it state-of-the-art today? I don't know. But was it state-of-the-art at the time of trial? It was. And so then you have a state-of-the-art model that someone's choosing not to use because they're waiting for the next model. And that's, you have to think about the trial aspects of that. The court didn't appreciate it. So again, on cross, right now, it's the most advanced scientifically available model for the Northeast metro area, and the DNR is choosing not to use it. Yes. We can't control climate, can we? No. We can control pumping, right? Yes. It's the DNR's responsibility to control pumping. Yes. It'd be irresponsible not to. Yes. So you can see that the science was heavily litigated, and I'm sure it's sort of uncomfortable for me to talk about in front of you. Well, this is all the DNR people in the room, but this is what happened at trial, and it's a public record. And like I said, I'm not attacking anyone, but the trials are about conflict and about drawing out the, you know, let's fight hard and see who wins. And so the court, I won't go through this, I'm running out of time, but the court found, you know, every violation of MARA, both passed. DNR violated four laws, also materially adversely impacted the environment. And they also violated its fiduciary duty to protect the lake bed under the public trust doctrine. Like I said, this is my personal opinion, that the two things that were most difficult for the community here was this residential irrigation ban and a contingency plan. So which means that if the lake drops so much that the DNR puts in a protected elevation and acts on it, you won't be able to use that water. What are you going to do then? And you need to plan ahead. Very unusual. There was a law then passed stopping the enforcement of our case. I won't comment on the constitutionality of that, but I'll say I can't give you another example in Minnesota of where that's been done. And just to show, this will just take a couple seconds. We ticked through. We knew we had to overprove our case, and so we did the 98. Stu's presentation covered all of these, the 98 DNR study, the 2010 Met Council study, the USGS studies. We went through all of them. We went through all these reports, the water chemistry. We went through everything. And we also did future growth. And so the Metropolitan Council, focuses on future growth, and they anticipate 30 to 47% growth in the Northeast metro area, 100% relying on groundwater. And so this 30% figure kept coming up. And so we know that if the groundwater use increases by 30% with no change of precipitation, the lake's going to drop by 1.5 feet, according to the Chapter B model. And we know if there's a 5% decline in precipitation, it's going to drop by 4.8 feet. And so we're back in this cycle again. So I hope that in this wealth of water, we're able to change our water use and hopefully at someday see a flip in this table. You can see that until the 1980s, there was more surface water used than groundwater, and then groundwater's taken off since then. So again, business as usual. This is DNR's own words. You know, trends suggest groundwater use might be unsustainable. Business as usual is no longer an option, and we're having negative impacts that are impacting our recreational and other uses. So I welcome any questions.
Thank you, Katie. I think that was very illuminating. I can see a question over there. Paul Poutier.
I know Paul well, so Mike Cerisi crossed him during trial, and Mike and I would often decide at council table who's going to cross the witness at the time, and I think we flipped and he got Paul.
No, I can see right now, I'm glad that it was your... it was Mike Cerisi on your team that asked me all the questions and not you. So
I got Jason and he got you. We were going to split them up.
That was fun. It was a lot of fun. It was good. So I still disagree with a lot of the conclusions that I heard, and I see a lot of what I would call cherry picking. Even in your slides with the yes and no's, I mean, in trial, they make you answer yes or no, even though the questions often have a lot more that you would want to say to them, right?
That's true.
And so some of the slides with Meckel and stuff, I could read what he would want to say that would really bring out more. But I think the problem is this raises a broader challenge for all of us in that we have the same set of scientific data. The DNR climatologist says we're in a drought over that last 15 years. Other scientists say we're not. So what can we expect from the public when all of us, and I like Stu's work, I trust Stu, we have a difference of opinion about the same information. And that's really the communication problem for scientists, is the public will hone in on that so fast. The different studies, the study one day that says bacon's good for you, the study that, well, never that one, eggs, and then, you know, eggs are bad for you. So, but I do have one question for you, a la the court, if you don't mind. You have to answer yes or no. So you made a lot of points about how being well prepared was important, Ms. Crosby Lehman. I really like that. I can see that you were... prepared. Do you agree that a better prepared legal case with better attorneys can result in an incorrect decision because of the better preparation and the better case running the case?
Well, has anyone seen My Cousin Vinny? They'd say
yes,
that's a bullshit
no,
question.
Planet, please. I'm done. Thank you. It was great to have you here.
So, I think we, okay, Kelton, is it short? If it's short, last one.
This is kind of a big picture question. Looking forward for the state, are we in a good place with our water law? And with your familiarity with water law in other parts of the country and maybe world, are there more enlightened water laws that we might want to be looking at and improving our mix of laws here?
I think we have incredible resources here. Dr. Ali Al-Hassan comes from Nevada and California. And so we have the Met Council expert who, I think he's still there actually, but who knows about all those different water laws, and I think they are ahead of us in the drought problems about shipping water and different problems that can come up. I personally don't have any criticism of our existing law. I don't think anyone's above the law, and I'm sure that's very clear from my testimony, but I do think that the law needs to be enforced against state agencies, and the only way to do that is to litigate this case under Section 3 and to be able to hold an agency accountable for violating the law. I don't see that we need to change the law.